Hello and welcome to another edition of the Pro Basketball Talk podcast here at NBC Sports. I am Kurt Heelan, the managing editor of Pro Basketball Talk. Joining us today, none other than our Pro Basketball Talk colleague and a guy who writes about the Bulls for Bleacher Report, Sean Hyken. Sean, how are you?
I'm good, Kurt. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Since you write so much and you know you live in Chicago, you write about the Bulls, you attend pretty much all their games, at least at the United Center. Let's start with them. This is a team, are they getting better? They seem to be playing better of late, or is that just my imagination?
You know, we're 15, 16 games into the season. I still have not figured out what this Bulls team is. They're 11-5. They have one of the best records in the league, one of the best records in the Eastern Conference, certainly. I don't feel like they're that good. And it's one of those weird things. And I think part of it is just because the offense, which was supposed to be this big thing that changed under Fred Hoiberg, just hasn't really been there. Like they're 27th in the league in offensive rating. With the only three teams behind them are the Lakers, the Nets, and the Sixers, which are the three worst teams in the league. But what's weird is that, you know, even though they decided to start Nikola Mirotic and Pau Gasol together, neither of whom can defend anybody, their defensive rating is fifth in the league.
Yeah, it's an odd mix. I mean, the front court rotation that you bring up, I mean, there were a lot of us who thought that maybe they would start Noah for defense and have Mirotic with him and bring Gasol off the bench, but I don't know if Hoiberg feels he can do that offensively. As bad as their offense is Gasol the one constant they have there?
Well, there's that, and I also just don't think that they wanted to ask Pau to come off the bench, because, I mean, you're in L.A., you remember, obviously, when Mike D'Antoni asked him to come off the bench.
Yes.
A couple of years ago, he didn't really react very well to it, and maybe that was a little bit different being asked to come off the bench for Jordan Hill than it would be for somebody like Noah or Taj Gibson or Mirotic, but, like, you know, I think Fred just kind of thought that Noah is going to be a team player, and he's going to react well to it, and he's not going to complain. And so he just kind of decided that was the path of least resistance. And the other thing is, if you remember how bad Joakim Noah was last year when he was coming off that knee surgery, he basically came back early from the surgery, playing hurt all year, and he was terrible. Like, I mean, because the year before, he was an MVP candidate. He was the first team All-NBA center. He was defensive player of the year. Last year, he could barely move. He was completely unplayable on offense, and he wasn't the player he used to be on the defensive end either. So I think Hoiberg decided that cutting his minutes a little bit and, you know, bringing him into a new role might be a better way to re-energize him. But I agree with you. I think just for the defensive purposes, the most sense would have been to start Mirotic and Noah together. But it seems like their defense hasn't really been hurting.
No, and they actually, you know, Gasol made the block at the end of the game the other day. They've actually made some defensive plays. And the other part of that is that they've got to keep Noah's minutes down. I mean, Noah isn't happy about his minutes, but this isn't part of the reason Hoiberg is there and Tom Thibodeau is, you know, on the coaches tour right now talking to everybody, is he wouldn't keep Noah's minutes down. He wouldn't keep everybody's minutes in check, and they need Noah, you know, in the playoffs, not now. So I think that that's part of it, and I just don't know that Noah is going to ever accept that just because of his personality.
Well, it's not just that. The other thing to keep in mind with Noah, and he would never admit that this is a factor, because he's, you know, every time we've asked him about this, he's always said, you know, I'm a team guy. I'm always going to do what's best for the team. He's going to be a free agent this summer. And if he's not playing as many minutes or he's not starting, that might affect the kind of money that someone wants to give him, whether it's the Bulls or somebody else. So, he's definitely, and he was on a pretty bargain contract for, you know, how good he was for most of his contract. He was getting about $12 million a year, which, you know, in today's landscape, if you had Joakim Noah in his prime before he kind of broke down over the last couple of years, $12 million a year for that version of Joakim Noah is one of the best contracts in the league. It's a steal. So I think Noah was kind of hoping that this summer, especially with the salary cap going up, and now that, like, he's won Defensive Player of the Year and stuff like that, I think he kind of thought that if he had another good season after last year, which was kind of disappointing, he'd get paid. And if he's coming off the bench and just kind of being used as a role player, that might not happen.
Are the Bulls intent on keeping him?
I have no idea. The thing is, he's up this summer. Pau Gasol has an opt-out, which I'm sure he's going to use.
Yeah, I'm sure
he's only making $7 million next year, and with the salary cap going up,
yeah, he'll make way more than that.
he'll get a lot more. Even though he's 35, he's going to get a lot more than that from somebody. I think he can probably squeeze one last. He's still playing at a high enough level on the
offense. Yeah, you got about. If, I wouldn't go long with him, but if you can get him with like 2 years and a team option or something, yeah, I'd pay him.
And like $10 million a year, yeah, I think he's still good enough to be worth that. So I think he's probably going to opt out. I don't know if the Bulls are going to re-sign him. And I think with Noah, obviously he means so much to this franchise and to the city. He's probably still the most popular player with the fans. Now that people are kind of starting to turn on Rose a little bit, which we'll talk about in a second. But Noah is the guy that gets the biggest cheers when he comes into the game. Noah does a ton of stuff in the community. He just seems like the typical way that you would think about an athlete from Chicago, or not from Chicago, but plays in Chicago, who's tough and no nonsense and all this stuff. Noah embodies that more than anybody else on the team. So he's extremely popular with the fans, the same way that Luol Deng was when they traded him. But, you know, from a pure basketball standpoint, he's 30. He's clearly on the downswing of his career at this point. And he's going to want still a kind of contract, which I think he'll be able to get from somebody else because he's still a name, and he still was Defensive Player of the Year only 2 years ago. I don't know if it's going to make too much sense for the Bulls to keep him. They might just decide that, especially because they have Mirotić, who's young. They have Bobby Portis, who they just drafted, who has barely played this year. He's, you know, they want to get him.
But I like him. I liked what I saw at Summer League and the flashes we've seen of him. I think he has real energy, bench energy guy potential.
Yeah, he was great in the preseason, too. He was getting a lot of minutes, and he just, once the season started, they just have too many guys at those positions between Gasol, Noah, Mirotić, and Taj Gibson. The thing is, last night they beat Denver, and Mirotić took an accidental elbow from Emmanuel Mudiay, mm-hmm. and he was diagnosed with a concussion. So he is probably going to miss, like, they're going to do the protocols, so we don't know when he's going to be back, but he's probably going to miss at least the next couple of games, just because teams are being a lot more cautious about concussions these days. So that could be an opportunity for Portis to get some real minutes, because he's only really played in a couple of games that were in garbage time so far this season. But, I agree with you. I think he's a guy they drafted. They weren't expecting him to be available at 22. I know that. They didn't even work him out because they thought he was going to go in the late lottery, and they had the 22nd pick. So when he fell to them, they just took him because he was the best player available. They really like him. But if they see him as a long-term part of their future, you maybe don't want to pay a lot of money to re-sign two guys who play similar positions, who are going to be making a lot of money, who are a lot older, who are on the downswing of their careers in Gasol and Noah. And the other thing is Taj Gibson. I feel like over the last 5 years, there's been talk constantly of whether the Bulls are going to trade him, and he's on a really good contract. He's going to be making, I think, 9 or 9.5 next year in the last year of his deal. He has a lot of trade value still, and he's another guy that's always been willing to come off the bench, willing to do whatever's best for the team, willing to sacrifice his own personal numbers. So he's another guy that has to make a decision on whether he is a long-term piece or whether they want to move him and try to get something, or wait and let him not re-sign in free agency. So if I had to guess, I think Gasol and Noah won't be back next year.
It's interesting. That Gasol particularly is interesting just because he's become such a key part of what they do. And they've got a lot of other decisions to make. I mean, this really, in a lot of ways, is a team transitioning because, as you mentioned, Derrick Rose, I mean, the city has turned on him in a lot of ways. And he is just, look, he is not the same player. And I don't know if he's accepted the role that he's going to be in now. He is simply not explosive MVP Derrick Rose anymore. There are moments he can get to the rim. He can finish a little and make some plays. They seem to still go to him a lot at the end of games, or at least it seemed that way to me. But he is defendable now, and not, look, this is, shouldn't this be Jimmy Butler's team?
It should be. I think there's no question that he's the best player on the team at both ends of the floor. I don't know where they would be without him right now. He's absolutely proving that max contract that he got this summer, he's worth that. And you know, there were definitely people who thought, you know, maybe what he did last year was a fluke, or that his improvement wasn't sustainable. I think we've clearly seen so far that it is. And, you know, this is definitely Jimmy Butler's. If it has to be one person's team, it's definitely Jimmy Butler's team right now. I think with, you know, how much the Bulls are going to Rose, and, you know, we asked Hoiberg about this actually last night after the game. He said they don't want to lose any of his aggressiveness. They want him to stay engaged. So I think that's why they're still going to him. But he's been bad. He's shooting 34% from the field. He's shooting 18% from 3-point range. He's 6 of 32 from three on the season.
Those are Kobe numbers.
Those are Kobe numbers. It's not. And actually, you know what? I saw my buddy Adi Joseph, who is the NBA editor of the Sporting News. These numbers are probably not current now because there have been a couple games since then. But Derrick Rose's true shooting percentage is actually 0.02% lower than Kobe's.
You're in that ballpark right now, it's not good.
It's not good. And so this is kind of he's just in a weird spot because if you know Derrick at all, he is adamant that he's going to be able to get back to being the player he was. He just has this way of, and it's kind of admirable if it weren't such a problem for the team, he has this way of just completely tuning out any kind of outside criticism. He says he doesn't listen to any of that stuff. He's still shooting threes. He's not shooting as many as he was last year, but he's still not he hasn't completely taken that part out of his game, but he was never a good 3-point shooter. And, I think at some point, if you would have to, Dwayne Wade never really developed a 3-point shot. At a certain point, you have to accept that. And you have to accept, you have to accept that you're going to have to change your game. And I think Derrick is at the point, the explosiveness. I think the thing about this, like right now, there's a little bit of the lingering effects of that facial injury he had during the training camps where he has double vision a little bit still and he has to wear a mask. His knees are fine. There have been no issues at all with his knees, which he's had three surgeries on in the last 3 years. And we've heard nothing about his knees are bothering him or anything like that. I think as far as his knees and the stuff that has been recurring for him, he's as healthy as he's going to be. And I think unfortunately, this might just be the player he is right now.
Yeah, I kind of think it is that way. And it's an acceptance thing in a way that we brought up Kobe. Even Kobe, the one thing that I took away from it being at the press conference where he announces the retirement is he was at peace with it. And a part of it was the realization that he can't be that guy anymore. All the work he puts in, everything he does, he's not getting his body to respond the way it used to, and that time has caught up with him. I don't think Rose has come near that point of acceptance.
No, not at all. And you know what? I actually, it wasn't just at that press conference that Kobe did that. I just recently this week, I rewatched that documentary that Kobe did on Showtime.
Muse, yeah. Which is fantastic. If you haven't seen it, by the way, it's really good.
It is great. And it's one of those, and this is a different conversation, but I usually don't like, the athlete-produced documentaries about themselves because they're usually just kind of PR. Like the Kevin Durant one was total fluff. And the Allen Iverson one, I think, was really sanitized from where it could have been. But the Kobe one, he was really honest in that documentary about how he isn't sure that he can get back to being the player that he was before the injuries. So I think this has got kind of a thing that he didn't just decide this recently. It's kind of a thing he's been slowly realizing over the last couple of years after the Achilles injury and then after that other leg injury he had, and certainly after the shoulder injury. And with how the first 10 or 15 games of the season have gone for him so far this year, I think, and he had a pretty good game last night against the Wizards. It's probably the best kind of game he's going to have this season, this version of Kobe. But it seems like he's been at that point, but he's always been a guy that's really willing to look at himself and find flaws in himself. And that's just something that I think that's been there his whole career. He holds himself to this impossibly high standard that he's his own harshest critic, and he's always been that way. Like, he's always, for all the talk, from Kevin Durant about how hard the media has been on him, every time Kobe has a bad night, he's going to be the first one to tell you, yeah, I suck tonight.
Yeah. I've been in the locker room when suck wasn't the S word he used to describe his play. And he's not shy about it. He was always hard on himself, but then he tries to hold everyone else to the other standards, which is to that level of standard, which has always been the challenge with Shaq and some of the other guys he's played with. Powell was the one guy who could handle it really well, just because Powell is the singular nicest human being in the NBA.
It's so true. This is my second season covering Powell. Now I've never covered a nicer person.
Yeah.
This is a funny story about that. Actually, a couple of days ago, the day after Kobe announced his retirement, the Bulls play the Spurs, and Powell usually doesn't talk pregame. Like, he has his routine. He will talk postgame. He won't talk pregame. But a couple of the newspaper guys went up and explained to Powell when he just kind of was passing through the locker room, look, we want to get your thoughts on Kobe, but we have newspaper deadlines. So if you talk after the game, then what you say about Kobe isn't going to be in the newspaper the next day. And so Powell was willing to then say, okay, well, I guess just today I'll talk pregame about Kobe. That's just the kind of guy
No, he is nice. He is also the lone, without getting into a lot of detail, he's the lone guy I had in conversation with literature about in the NBA because he was reading a famed Portuguese author that I happened to be reading at the time. And the book was just in the bookshelf, and I'm like, he's like, oh, I just started that. It's fantastic. And we spent like 2 minutes talking like literature. And I'm like, I could not have this conversation with anyone else in the league.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. And Pau is also just, I told this story. I think I've told you this story. I told this on another podcast too, but a couple weeks ago I was in Portland visiting my family, like over the Thanksgiving holiday during the Bulls road trip. And I went to the Nike employee store.
Nice.
While the Bulls were in town, because I have a friend whose dad works for Nike, so I can get in whenever I'm in Portland. But Pau was there just buying stuff. And so I just kind of said hi to him and just kind of kept it moving. And then about 20 minutes later, I bump into him and he says, are you finding everything okay? Like he was like like he was an employee like trying to help me or something. But that's just kind of who Pau is.
Yeah, he is genuine. And the good person stories about Pau and the stories that come out of him spending time out here in L.A. when
and he like visits sick kids at the hospital, him and his brother both.
But the best part was he starts talking because remember, he was pre-med. Like his mom's right. A doctor. He did some pre-med work back in Barcelona. So the doctors are like, well, and I'm not going to remember the disease, but this child had this spinal thing. And they're like, so we're going to do this procedure where we do this, and they're just kind of vague and joking around, not joking, but like basic 101, trying to talk down to him, athlete stuff. And he turns and says, well, how are you going to balance out this metabolic and nails like four things? And they're looking at him like, what? Like they had no idea. And they ended up bringing him into the kid's surgery so they could see, he could see how it was done. Like it, yeah.
Is that allowed?
He is a unique person in the NBA.
Is that allowed to like to bring someone who's not a doctor into
as an observer? Yeah, I mean, go watch the Nick, the TV show from the 90s when the surgical theaters. Yeah, yeah. If you get a chance, by the way, if you've got Showtime, I'm off topic. Just thing to go do. I'm really high on the Nick. You got to start with season one. It's a Steven Soderbergh New York hospital circa 1900, but it is phenomenal. It is phenomenally shot. It is really well done.
I've heard good things about it. I just haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah, that's what if you. I don't know where it's available because I'd switched cable companies, so I have Showtime right now. I don't know though. Where else you can stream it. But it's worth getting. Back to the Bulls for a second though.
Right.
Is it too early? I guess it is too early to judge Hoiberg. But what's your impression, or do you have an impression of him yet?
Well, I think he's just kind of still figuring a lot of stuff out. Like he. You kind of knew that this was going to happen with a college coach who has no NBA coaching experience, making the transition from, and this is something that something that I've actually talked about a little bit with our friend Vincent Goodwill, who's actually sort of a colleague of ours because he's a Bulls beat writer for CSN.
I'm sure, by the way, he will be on this podcast later this year talking Bulls with me, and we'll talk badly about you behind your back.
Yeah, of course. Now, Vince is a great guy. But anyway, he was saying that basically the college coach basically has a lot more control over the message and over this kind of stuff, especially in a market like Iowa State.
Yeah.
And he isn't really used to having every single thing he does scrutinized the way you do when you're the coach of the Chicago Bulls in the NBA. So that's kind of an adjustment period, just like in terms of, being able to tell us things about injuries and things like that. But as far as a coach goes, I think he's still just kind of throwing rotations out there. For the first like week of the season, he didn't play Gasol and Noah together at all. And then he's been playing them more together recently. He moved McDermott into the starting lineup, and then he moved him back to the bench because he decided he liked him better at the bench scorer, a.k.a. McDermott is such a liability on the defensive end that he thought that Tony Snell was less damaging there.
Yeah.
So I think he's still kind of figuring it out. The thing that's interesting is that he, when they hired him, and I said this earlier, they hire him, and the selling point with him, not just that he and the front office get along, which was obviously, way past the point of no return with Tom Thibodeau by the time things ended in that relationship, but he has this up-tempo offense that's very, very focused on spacing, very fast-paced, and, after the way that the offense had been, kind of middle of the road under Thibodeau, they kind of wanted to change there, especially, because they thought that would make Mirotić better, it would, help Rose out, it would help McDermott. But their offense is still one of the worst in the league. So I don't know if it's just an effort thing or he's still installing plays, but McDermott said something weird at shootaround yesterday where he was saying that they're starting to run things that they ran last year to make guys more comfortable. So that was kind of a weird thing. I don't really know what's going on with that. I don't know. I think it's too early to judge Hoiberg, and I think he's a smart enough guy that he's going to be able to figure it out. But early on, he had a lot of adjusting to do. He's still kind of figuring out which lineups work, which ones don't. And I mean, the fact is, like, I think the first time it might be kind of like Stan Van Gundy in Detroit, where the first year it didn't go great, but now this year it's going better because he has a roster that actually fits his style. The Bulls literally, except for drafting Bobby Portis, everything else is exactly the same. They have the exact same roster as far as the guys that actually play. They brought back Butler. They brought back Aaron Brooks. They brought back Dunleavy, who hasn't played yet this year. He's injured. I don't know when he's going to be back. But it's the exact same roster that still kind of has that mentality of being a Tom Thibodeau team. And I think next year, with so many guys up, with Noah up, with Gasol up, with, you know, a lot of guys coming up and, you know, a lot of potential for player movement, I think they're going to be able to build a roster next year that's going to be a little bit better suited to the kind of offense that Fred Hoiberg wants to play. So I think you can't really judge him fully yet, just because I think the roster is not really there, and also because he's still kind of figuring out which lineups to use. But I think he'll figure it out eventually.
Yeah, but and through all this, through all the things we're saying they're wrong, like you said at the start, they're 11-5, and I think that this is a team that gets better as the year goes on. And look, we're still trying to figure out who is going to be the team that makes the Eastern Conference Finals and ends up being the roadkill for Cleveland, right? So I think that this Bulls team is in that mix. I mean, along with the Pacers, who have played phenomenally well of late, I'm higher on Miami. They're defending. I'm a little higher on. I think their offense comes around. But and Toronto, everybody keeps, I just did it now. Kyle Lowry's been an absolute stud so far this season.
He hasn't. Damari Carroll has fit in really well defensively with them. I mean, losing Valanciunas is going to hurt for the next couple of weeks. But, if they get him back and he's fine by the playoffs, I think they'll be right in there. Yeah, I agree with you. Atlanta has,
I've been sleeping on them. And,
they're not as good as they were last year. And I knew that was going to happen as soon as they let Damari Carroll go. But they're still in there. They're still respectable. And I think most of those teams were ones that we kind of saw coming early on. The one that's really surprising is Indy. Especially after that first week they had of the season. I think they lost their first three games of the season. They started the year like 1-4. But since then, I mean, maybe this is just because Paul George is incredible and he looks exactly like he did before the leg injury. Better.
That's, I mean, he did not have that jump shot before the leg surgery.
This is the best Paul George there has ever been, as a basketball fan, that's so encouraging that, you know, so many of these guys come back from these really bad injuries and they're not the same. And, you know, Paul George is arguably better than he was before the injury, which is really awesome. And, you know, Vogel's such a good coach. Monte is actually fitting in pretty well there. Yeah. I really like what Miles Turner was doing before he got injured.
Yeah. They've got CJ Miles stepping up for them. They've got, and I'll tell you, again, I got to talk to Vogel when he was out here in LA a little.
Vogel's the best.
And the one guy you don't feel like, you know, most NBA coaches who are former players tower over you. Vogel, who wasn't a player, you know, at least it's eye to eye for those of us who are 6 foot.
Right.
He, though, seemed a little surprised how well they were playing early. He said, you know, look, we've always had confidence in this system. I didn't know we would be this good this fast. And I think that, you know, obviously there was some adjustment with Paul George at the four and how that was going to go. And there's certain matchups now where they just still go away from it. But that's how it should be. Like, unless you can go small like Golden State, you kind of do have to be a little bit matchup dependent. They've picked their spots and it's worked fantastically. They are legit. They are legitimately in that second tier in the East.
Yeah, absolutely. But as far as, you know, the second tier in the East, I think we've kind of covered what all the teams are. You know, the Bulls, I think, are certainly in that tier, and especially if they ever get Dunleavy back. And at this point, I don't know when that was going to happen.
Seeing more specialists now, and they're not sure.
Right, because he had the surgery like a week before training camp started. And originally they said 8 to 10 weeks, and then he just had a setback this week, and he's seeing more specialists. So I think there's a chance, they haven't put a timetable on it, but I think there's a chance he might not be back until like around the All-Star break or maybe after that, which, you know, and he, that's certainly not going to solve all of their problems offensively, but he's a solid three-point shooter. He's a good team defender. You know, he's just kind of one of those guys that just knows where he needs to be and does what he needs to do, and he doesn't really get in the way too much. So that's a guy that's going to help them, but they don't know when they're going to get him back. But I think the Bulls are about the same team they were last year. They're going to win 50 games and lose in the second round or maybe the conference finals. I don't think this is a title contender.
No.
Mostly because I don't think there's any title contenders in the East that aren't Cleveland.
Yeah. You and I are on the same page there. I think Cleveland has the best record in the East, and by the way, they don't even have their starting backcourt yet.
So. Right. Right. If they're this good, I think it's because, I mean, they finally figured out how to use Kevin Love. Like, last year, that seemed like such an awkward fit. But they are so dominant when him and LeBron are on the floor at the same time.
Yeah. By the way, that gets interesting. I'm curious how that starts to blend when Kyrie gets back. So, I mean, they've still got some stuff to work out. But if your problem is how are we going to add Kyrie Irving effectively, that's a good problem to have.
And Amon Shumpert.
Yeah, they're starting best defending two guard. Yeah.
That's a good problem to have.
Exactly.
How are we going to, this multiple-time all-star point guard, how are we going to be able to reintegrate him? Is he going to be an upgrade over Matthew Dellavedova? Like, is that going to mess with the system? I think most teams who have problems will trade their problems for that problem in a heartbeat.
Exactly. Let's start to look around some of the other problems and issues and other just news around the NBA. And when you talk about problems, I think we got to talk about Jahlil Okafor, who's been suspended now for a couple of games for... A lot of stuff. Well, I think what got them in trouble, and Brett Brown talked about this on Thursday morning at their shoot around, it's not just the, another video came out. It's that he didn't tell them everything. That he was kind of like, all right, I'm really sad. He wanted this to just go away, it sounds like.
Right.
So he kind of played it down, and now, like, hey, welcome to the social media world. If there's stuff, it's going to be found. And it got found, and I think that's what frustrated them more than anything. So he's been out a couple games, but are you with me on this? This is not, for Okafor, this is not a long-term issue. This is something I think he gets past pretty quickly.
I tend to agree with you on that, especially because he's not a guy coming into the draft. The book on him was always, oh, he's such a good kid, he's so mature. He never had any kind of off-court issues, you know, in high school or in college or coming into the draft. So this isn't a guy where you draft him and you take a risk that, you know, something like this might happen. He's one of the guys that you were told you didn't have to worry about with this stuff. So I think I'm just going to, for the most part, I'm just going to chalk this up to he's 19 and 19-year-olds do stupid stuff sometimes. And,
I didn't, you know, but yes.
And you can't completely absolve him of stuff because he shouldn't have been doing. You know, he shouldn't have, besides just the fighting, he shouldn't have been driving 108 miles per hour in a 40-mile zone. Like, he either could have been killed or somebody else could have been killed in that scenario. The fake ID, I don't care about at all. But the other stuff is, you know, each incident individually, you could kind of look past. But all of them together, like, in such a short span of a few weeks, is kind of troubling. But I think, you know, just with the fallout from this stuff, you know, and the suspension and, you know, how much he's had to kind of apologize to everybody on social media and just, like, how much of a bad look this is for him. I think he's probably learned his lesson at this point about not getting himself into these situations. One thing that's interesting angle that I haven't seen talked about much, and, you know, Michael Lee wrote a pretty good column about this on Yahoo a few days ago after the first video came out, but the Sixers don't have any veterans on their team to tell these young guys, look, this is how you should and shouldn't handle these situations. And I'm not saying that would have solved everything, but if they had just even had a couple of veterans, I'm not even talking about like a veteran star, I'm talking about just someone like Jared Dudley, who's just like a smart guy and, you know, knows how to handle stuff, to just get it after the first incident, just get in Okafor's ear and say, look, this is how you have to handle this stuff. You know, they might not be in this situation. That's kind of a hidden downside. And I get what the Sixers are trying to do with just trying to find a lot of young talent that may slip through the cracks. But this is why it's worthwhile to have veterans on your team to at least, you know, have that kind of influence.
You've got to have veterans that have the right voice. And with all due respect to, you know, Carl Landry, who's not playing but is in there now, Luke Richard Mabunte, who was in there for a couple of years before he's in L.A. this year, but was there. Those aren't the voices. You know, Minnesota is the obvious, easy example. I mean, KG is a, Garnett is a loud voice, but remember there's Andre Miller is in there, like, you know, working with
Rubio. Tayshaun Prince.
Right. Good, solid veteran guys. Teaching them, look, does it stop the incident in Boston? Maybe not. Probably not, maybe. You know, I don't know that it does.
But it makes it less likely that something like this is going to happen again, which is what the important thing
is. Yeah, and it teaches them how to be professionals in preparation and all this stuff. Somebody's got to be guiding them, and Brett Brown has said, like, look, I've got to do a lot of this. I've got to teach them how to be professionals. You're better with that being done by example in the locker room rather than how they're handling it. So I think that's my one concern. I think you're right. The other thing with Philadelphia, and this is something that they have to consider now as an organization, is
right. They're
bringing in a lot of rookies over the next couple of years. I mean, they're going to have the Laker pick this season or next, depending on when it falls out of the top three.
I think the Lakers keep their pick this year somehow.
The way they're playing right now, yeah. But beyond that, I mean, they've got a bunch of other people's picks coming in, obviously their own. Over the next couple of years, Saric is going to come over. They're going to bring in a ton of young players. And you have got to have a structure in place to help guide them. Not just veterans, but I mean in terms of making sure that there's people around them, making sure there's security to help them when they're out off the court. All this stuff that they didn't seem to have in place that other organizations do. And it's, look, you can't do this stuff in the NFL with, 20 first and second year players on every roster and just the turnover there. In the NBA, even on a team like the Sixers, it is very feasible to have very structured systems for these guys to help them transition, and that didn't seem to be there, and with everything they've got coming in, this is something that they as an organization have to really sit down and look at.
Right, and I mean, if you look at another example of a team that's kind of building the same way, is Portland. Like, they lost, yeah. They lost four of their five starters, so they have a lot of just young, unproven guys on their roster right now, but they have this infrastructure in place where, they have a culture that they've already established. The Sixers are just kind of like, And I don't want to get into the whole, hashtag trust the process argument and have all the Sixers fans in my mentions, because I get what they're doing. But, like, they're just kind of throwing stuff at the wall and hoping something sticks, and that's not the way to actually build a team. Like, at some point, you've got to become an actual team.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the process can work. I'm one of those people who thinks all this work that Hinkie has done is going to be another coach and another GM will end up turning it into something. Like, he will have brought in the raw materials, but I'm not sure that he's going to be the guy there for all the building of it. Andrew Bogut was interviewed in Rolling Stone, and you had brought this to my attention. Do you have this quote that you liked so much from Andrew Bogut during his long Rolling Stone interview?
I do. So our friend Sirit Sohi did the interview with Andrew Bogut in Rolling Stone, and she asked him about the comparisons that the Warriors, who now are 20-0 on the season, best start in NBA history, 20-0, the Warriors, are getting to the 95-96 Bulls that went 7-10. And, you guys like Ron Harper and Dennis Rodman have come out and said that, the 96 Bulls would destroy the current Warriors. And Bogut, Bogut starts off his answer to that by saying, it's pointless to compare, but I love this in particular. He says, I just don't see myself in 10, 15, or 20 years belittling teams just because we won a championship or, we had a good record. I hope that I won't be a grumpy old man who's belittling all the younger guys. I just don't see myself doing that.
You know what? I love that he said that, because to me, it is so impossible to compare. And this happens in football, I think, even way more than like baseball or something.
Well, baseball, like the whole point of baseball is like that you haven't changed a lot of the rules, so you can sort of cross-compare eras.
But you can't do it in football, and you can't do it in the NBA.
No.
Particularly. Right now, the way defense was allowed to be played determined the offense and things in that Bulls era. What Golden State is doing, you can say there should be hand-checking, you'd like to see the more physical game. Personally, I don't miss that. I do not. Because the ultimate...
I think the NBA game is in a pretty good spot
yeah.
right now.
Yeah, well, the thing is, people are saying, I missed the 90s. Well, what you miss is Michael Jordan. But
you don't miss the 90s. Some of those, whenever those games are on NBA TV, whenever like some of those Knicks-Heat playoff games, those games are unwatchable.
Oh, God, if people forget about how just slowed down, grinding, banging it was, and that was not good, entertaining basketball, it was a street fight. And that isn't the NBA. I find this a more entertaining product. But beyond that, what Golden State does offensively what Tom Thibodeau set up defensively, starting with in Boston and bringing to Chicago and through that, are all tied to the changes in the defensive rule, allowing you to play zone, taking away the hand checking, all that stuff. You can't compare across those eras, just because as much as if you put these, if you played mid-90s rules with those Jordans, those Jordan teams, yeah, they destroy these Golden State teams. But if you told, and I've had this conversation with Gary Payton, I said, could you play? He goes, I don't know if I can play defense in today's NBA.
Right.
I'm not allowed to hand check. You have to.
He'd foul out after 5 minutes every game.
Yeah. You can't play defense that way. So these guys would have to learn how to, you've got to be a much smarter defensive player. The systems are a little more complex. The rotations are faster. All this help defense stuff that we talk about now, it's not that it wasn't there, but it's got to be a lot faster now. You can double earlier. You can take the post away. You know, I listening to Shaq sometimes on TNT drives me nuts, because I'm like, you know, you can't do it. As great a post player as Shaq was, you know what would happen? They do what they do to a lot of guys now, front and back him. Before, you just take away the post pass. Beat me another way, but you are not going to lob it into Shaq and let him set up on the post. You couldn't do that before. You couldn't double team him before he got the ball without getting a zone call. So it just, all this kind of stuff is so different that if the rules were in favor of Golden State style, guess what? They'd probably beat those Bulls teams, because they are built to play this way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reason I like this Bogut quote is just because I'm kind of tired of just seeing, you know, every other week, you know, in the NBA news cycle, we'll see just X retired player says that X good current player or good current team would get destroyed in their era, because of course their era is the best. And I just like that Andrew Bogut is kind of saying, you know, I'm not going to do that when I'm retired, and who knows whether he will or not. But I kind of think that just this might be, and I was actually talking about this with Siret yesterday after I read her interview with Bogut, but like I kind of think this might be the last, this might be the end of kind of that, just because a lot of these current guys in the social media era, like LeBron is so used to just having everything that he does and every amazing thing that he does. Like he was incredible in the finals this year, and he still got killed by some people because it wasn't Jordan or it wasn't Kobe or it wasn't this or it wasn't that. I think LeBron, you know, guys like LeBron and Durant have had to deal with that their whole career. So I don't really see LeBron in 15 years saying, oh, well, Ben Simmons would have gotten killed in my era. That just doesn't seem like something LeBron would do, because he had to deal with that his whole career, but basically just being told everything that he did, and he's one of the 10 greatest players of all time, everything he did isn't worthwhile because it's not Bird or it's not Jordan or it's not Magic.
Yeah, I think that the social media aspect of that does change that a little bit, but people get old and they get... I don't think it goes away for this reason. These guys, I mean, that was... It sounds like a Bruce Springsteen song. This was their glory days. This was the best points in their life, and they're going to relive it. And if they're, you know, somebody's challenging that, I don't know that it'll be Curry, but you know, who knows? Draymond will still be talking. Like Draymond won't stop talking.
Draymond will never not be talking.
So, you know, somebody will be and saying, hey, I don't know if they could have hung with us. And that's, you know, it's a fun Barstool debate, I guess. I am with you. I kind of get weary of those kinds of discussions. Just like I occasionally get weary of trade rumors, but there is one out there that I think that drew a lot of attention, and that is that Houston is already testing the market to see what kind of value they could get for Ty Lawson. Is that a surprise?
It is and it isn't. I think they really... I kind of thought that the Ty Lawson thing was going to work out a lot better than it has, especially because... You know, he, when they traded him, when they did the trade with Denver, he agreed to fully unguarantee the final year of his contract. So he really has to do it this year, or he might be out of the league, or maybe not out of the league, but not getting paid nearly as much money. I think they owe him like $12 or $13 million next season. So he really kind of is in his, this is kind of his last chance to really prove that he is, you know, in this conversation of elite point guards, and that he's a guy you want to have on your team after all these off-court issues. I thought it was going to work out better, but I also didn't really see the Rockets being as bad as they were, firing Kevin McHale 10 games into the season, and James Harden regressing the way he has from last year when he almost won MVP to this year. He just kind of stopped trying on defense, isn't shooting as efficiently as he did. You know, with the way that things are going now with the Rockets, if you had told me at the beginning of the season that a month in they'd be shopping Ty Lawson, I would have been a little bit surprised. But if you tell me that right now, after the way the beginning of the season has gone for them, I'm not really surprised at all.
Yeah. There's also just stuff that I talk about a team like the Bulls still trying to figure out some rotation stuff. You just can't play Harden and Lawson together. They're two guys who have to have the ball in their hands to create. And I always thought that Lawson was going to come off the bench. Now, Patrick Beverley's injuries played into that a little bit. But
right.
To me, he's always been the guy who should run the second unit. But how many minutes can you... You're still going to have to overlap some minutes, and it became... It's going to become challenging. And beyond that, I mean, they're just... They won again last night in a game where they were just sloppy to start the game. They were lucky that they were playing a team they could come back and beat, because that listlessness was still there, and there's still a real, whatever their chemistry issues are in that locker room, whoever's not cracking down or whatever's going on, it is kind of lazy basketball at times, and they've got enough talent that they're still going to make the playoffs, but they're not good.
Right, it's kind of like that Lakers team the year that Dwight was there.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, they have too much talent not to turn it around eventually, but, and, you know, I don't know if you're okay with this, but I think we should take down our preseason predictions post, because I picked Houston to win the title, and I really don't want that on my record. Like, they can't be in that conversation anymore.
No, they cannot.
Whatsoever. But, you know, this might be another team, and I guess the closest thing they have to a veteran, you know, we were talking about this earlier with the Sixers, and it's obviously not nearly as extreme as it is there, but who are the veterans on the Rockets? Like, Dwight Howard is, you know, a three-time defensive player of the year and, you know, was the best player on a team that made the finals, but he's never really been seen as this serious guy who can get in people's ears and, like, lead them and get them to handle situations the right way. Who's the guy like that on the Rockets? Is it Jason Terry? Is he the veteran?
Yeah,
is he the closest thing they have to that?
He is, and he's barely playing, and that leaves them in a tough spot, because look, who are their... Look, the two clear leaders on that team are Harden and Howard, and they're both kind of goofballs.
Right, they are. Like, that, not saying that makes them, you know, bad people or anything, but no. Like, they need, you know, an Andre Miller or a Tayshaun Prince.
They
or
needed,
somebody
you know,
like...
who, you know who they needed? They need David West. And David West is in the perfect spot for David West in
David
San
West
Antonio.
Not but, put up with any of this stuff.
Yeah, but this wouldn't be happening if they had that kind of guy there in that locker room. I agree.
It's almost unfair that the Spurs, the team that need that kind of veteran, you know, calming presence the least, is the team that gets him for the minimum after he opts out of $12 million with Denver.
Yeah, that was a surprise, but I talk about, he was the one guy, you know, and I think that just speaks to the character we're talking about, who was, very few guys would have ever walked away from that kind of money to chase a ring, and he did. I mean, he went to, look, right now I think that there are three clear teams that have a shot at a ring in... Mm-hmm. The top tier right now is Cleveland, especially because they'll get
well,
better.
Well, no, the top tier is Golden State. That's the top tier.
Yeah, but I mean, Cleveland will come out of the East, but the top tier in the West, it's Golden State, but San Antonio's nipping their heels. They're not that far back.
I agree. I just saw them on Monday. Kawhi Leonard is a monster. Like, yeah. He's made such a leap offensively. He's really, you know, become comfortable being the first option, which combined with... He's basically like a better version of what Jimmy Butler is doing for the Bulls. Like, he's got that jump shot now. And he's probably the best defensive player in the entire league.
Yeah. Yeah, he's come a long way. And so you've got those two. Then I guess Oklahoma City is third. They've still got a lot of things to figure out there. And then I still think the Clippers will figure it out better than they have.
But kind of out on the Clippers, to be honest with you.
Yeah, they're... I'll ask you why. I mean, part of it is right now. I mean, they looked bad last night. But look, if you get rid of... J.J. Redick sprained his ankle seconds into the game, and they didn't have Chris Paul. And if you replace them with Austin Rivers and Jamal Crawford, it's a bit of a drop.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think they're going to be, I think they can make the second round. I don't see the path to them becoming a title contender. You know, DeAndre Jordan regressing on defense, it's becoming a problem. Cause like that was the thing. Like, it was such a big deal when they got him back after he almost went to Dallas. And then, you know, all this other depth that they added, Josh Smith has been great for them. But
yeah, he's been phenomenal.
But when you're talking about a guy that you just re-signed, like DeAndre Jordan, who was one of the best defensive centers in the league last year, and they're not playing him late in games, that's a problem. I just kind of think this core of the Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, DeAndre core has just kind of gone as far as it's going to go, and that's not an indictment of any of those guys. Like, this stuff just doesn't work out sometimes, and they got a lot of depth that was kind of a... a big thing, for this summer, why a lot of people thought they were going to be contenders. But, like, Lance Stephenson has been he's been pretty good lately, and maybe he's figuring it out.
I think Doc is using him better as the guy with the ball in his hands with the second unit, which is always where he would have thrived. So, I still think
the Clippers are good, and I think they're a playoff team, and I think they're a second round team, but I really cannot put them in the same sentence as, like, Golden State and San Antonio and even Oklahoma City if they're healthy.
Yeah, exactly. I tend to agree. And I'll tell you, and it's a whole nother podcast in another day, and we're not there yet, but there is a growing sense around the Clippers that what you're saying, that this core can't get where they want to be, is sinking in, and there's a little bit of panic. There's a little bit of, what can we do? What do we have to put it? What do we have to bring in? What do we have to do? What has to change?
But the problem is, they don't have anything. What can they do to bring more guys in? They don't have anything to trade. They don't have anything to trade. They aren't going to have cap space because they signed Blake, they signed DeAndre, they signed Chris Paul. Even with the cap going up, they don't really have a lot of flexibility to do anything. They've traded all their picks. Like, this is just what the Clippers are just going to have to ride this core out for another couple of years, unless they want to blow it up and trade Chris or trade Blake, which, I think that's a little bit extreme.
Yeah, I they will not change. They will never trade Blake. I almost say never. No. Never say never, but for people.
I tend to agree with you. You're obviously more, being in LA, you're obviously more plugged into that than I am. But I just, he's the guy, like, they drafted him. He's been one of the most popular players in the league. He's probably going to get a stat. He's probably going to be the first Clippers player to get a statue outside of Staples. He's going to be the first Clippers player to have his number retired. I think he's, as long as he's willing to re-sign there when he's a free agency, I think he's going to stay with the Clippers forever.
Yeah, and I think that you're right in that this was the guy who changed the franchise for them. Uh-huh. This was the guy they drafted who has, by the way, crazy work ethic. Like, he gets better every year. This guy is a phenomenal worker, and he was the guy who changed the culture.
It's the guy that people are down on because he's in a lot of commercials and stuff, but that guy works his butt off. And he also, like you said, he transformed the team. Chris Paul doesn't agree to be traded there if they don't have Blake.
Oh, exactly. And a lot of other things happen. Going back to, the guy who never gets, and like I said, this is a whole nother podcast, but a guy who doesn't get enough credit there, Mike Dunleavy was, as the coach GM role, was the guy who convinced Donald Sterling, like, you don't realize you've got the once in a, the cornerstone player here, the guy that's impossible to get. It is time to put our big boy pants on. And so Dunleavy wanted to do things like trade Baron Davis. Now, that wasn't hard to get past ownership. They were heckling him from the front row. But Baron Davis's work ethic was not the guy you wanted in that locker room as a veteran with all these guys you're bringing. Like, it was time to make that kind of culture change, and they needed to do it because of Blake, and that transformed everything. So that he'll never be gone unless he leaves as a free agent, and I'm not sure that he's going to.
Well, no, because he's a guy, like I said, he does commercials, he does all this other stuff. He wants to be in the LA market.
Yeah, so one other thing, and I think it's time for, when you think of Sean and I, and if you knew us personally, you'd realize that fashion is our strong suit.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, exactly. We are fashion mavens.
We're both very, very fashionable individuals.
Yes. So what do you think, Adidas and the NBA released the new All-Star uniforms for the Toronto game this year? We're both going to be there. What did you think of them?
I love them.
Yeah.
I think they kind of looks like the Raptors' new uniforms that they introduced this year. Like, they have kind of the same font, just like that same kind of basic, one color for the jersey, one color for the lettering. They have that kind of that basic thing that the Raptors have. I think it works really well. And I mean, mostly, I think my bar for All-Star uniforms is pretty low at this point, because after New Orleans in 2014, I generally like start off as being in on anything that doesn't have sleeves. But I think I liked what they did last year in New York, and I really like what they did this year.
Yeah.
And I also, like, on sort of on this topic, I like the Christmas jerseys a lot too. I've started to see a few of those at Bulls games. I've seen a couple Jimmy Butler, Christmas jerseys, Pau Gasol Christmas jerseys with the cursive lettering that they have for all the teams. I really like those too. I think the NBA this year has done a really good job with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Christmas ones. Even more, I like these All-Star ones, not as much as New York, but I do like them because, look, they're clean, they're simple, they're not trying to be over the top. That whole New Orleans trying to do the Mardi Gras thing with the uniform went a little over the top. You're right. It's kind of funny that now that Adidas has given up the contract, they've actually been way better the last couple of years. So,
well, I think there might be part of it. Part of it might be that the NBA was willing to let New Orleans, I mean, not New Orleans, so to let Adidas experiment with all this stuff because they knew, I think that both sides probably knew that that partnership was not going to be continuing. Once Nike, when is it? Is it 2018 that Nike is going to get?
Is it next year or the year after? I forget now.
I'm pretty sure it's 2018.
Okay.
That Nike is going to get the contract. I think we're going to see sleeves completely go away then.
You know, we'll see. It's a marketing thing. Are they selling? And I don't know the answer to this, but are they selling enough of those?
This is just anecdotal, but I've never seen somebody at a game wearing a sleeve jersey.
The thing is, you're selling it as if it's a t-shirt. Then you're putting that logo on a t-shirt because you're right. I'm not going to buy the sleeve jersey. But I'm also, you know, I get what they're trying to do in the sense that, you know, not everybody who wears jerseys to a game, tank top jerseys to a game, should. And
I get the
move to try to do the t-shirt thing, but yeah, I don't, you know, I think LeBron spoke for a lot of us when he just ripped it.
Well, LeBron has been pretty outspoken about it for a while. And I actually went back in 2014 at that All-Star game in New Orleans. I asked a bunch of players at the availability what they think about the sleeves, and Steph Curry was saying, you know, I'm a shooter and it messes with my shooting stroke. Just anything. Like, these guys are so fanatical about just any part of the uniform. Like, and it all has to be a certain way. They all have their own ways that they like to do stuff. Like, some will wear a shooting sleeve on one arm. Some will, you know, wear a wristband. Some will, you know, wear their jersey tucked in a certain way. They're all very particular about this kind of stuff, and it's a very individual thing. So saying to everybody, okay, well, do what already your routine is with the uniforms, now you're going to add sleeves to it. It doesn't really go over well. A lot of guys, like you said, like, I get why they're doing it. I'm fine with them selling something like that as a t-shirt, but making the players wear it too, and especially the gray ones. Like, when they do gray on the sleeve jerseys, it's just, the Bulls had these quote unquote pride jerseys a few weeks ago at a game, and it was just the worst thing I've ever seen. And like, the Rockets have a gray one, the Celtics have one,
everybody's
Magic
doing
have
gray
one.
Now I mean,
I don't know why
a lot of them.
I don't get it. I actually kind of like those Pistons chrome.
No, the two Pistons, their Motor City ones last year, and then the chrome auto. There's an, I forget the term off the top of my head. They sent me the press release on it ages ago, but the chrome like auto throwback one I like. By the way, can we just be clear though? The best throwbacks were the Memphis ones. The ABA Sounder throwbacks were phenomenal.
Those are amazing. I kind of wish that the Grizzlies, because I mean, the Grizzlies name, and I guess that it's kind of associated with the, you know, that now that they have, you know, 5 or 6 years of being a playoff team and having this grit and grind identity, I get that, like, the Grizzlies name is kind of entrenched in Memphis, but that was a name that was a carryover from when they moved from Vancouver. I kind of wish that, and I don't think this is really realistic, but I kind of wish that they would go back to that identity, the kind of the way that that the Bobcats went back to the Hornets after that name became available. I mean, yeah, those Sounders jerseys are great, but you know, I still think nothing touches the Warriors the city jerseys that they've been wearing
awesome
a couple times this season. Those are phenomenal.
Yeah, and by the way, a lot of people picked on and really don't like the Pelicans name in New Orleans.
I love it.
But you know what? It's local. It means something. It's not the Jazz in Utah or the Lakers, even in that, which is an iconic thing, but it was named after the Minnesota Lakes, you know.
Right.
There's all these very teams move and they don't change the names, and I'd rather you change the name to something local, because Hornets, again, without getting into it, Hornets is something that goes back to the Revolutionary War in Charlotte. Like, it is a entrenched part of their identity. Hornets things are like on the badge for police there on their shoulder sleeves and stuff. It is part of that identity of that city, and to just pull it and throw it in, you know, not that there are not Hornets in New Orleans, I imagine there are, but it's not the same thing, so.
I love the Pelicans name when they announced it. I love it now. I love the logo.
I'm not the biggest fan of the mascot, but aside that.
I like the old mascot when he was scary.
Now he's a little too nice and safe for you.
They made it too tame. They came out with this mascot, and it was amazing, and there were all these, the first night they unveiled it on Twitter, there were just all these incredible photoshops, and it was one of the greatest nights on Twitter that I can remember. But then I think they got some market research back and said that, you know, kids who were at the game were scared of it, and so they made this big show out of having him get injured and having to, you know, get surgery, and then they just made it too nice. Like, I miss the old Pierre.
Yeah, well, let's be honest, you and I like the first Pierre, but that was the, you know, scary clown Pierre. I get why they might not want to do that for Kansas.
I get it too. I miss the old days.
So cool. Well, Sean, thanks for doing this. Thanks for being on. We're going to have you on a lot over the course of the season, and we will talk to you soon. Thanks for doing this. And guys, check back. We will have this podcast every Monday and Thursday, hopefully. We're aiming for every Monday and Thursday at Pro Basketball Talk. Thanks.